Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Many of us have smartphones and smart televisions. Some of us have smart cars and smart homes. Smart watches are hitting the market. And of course, smart glasses are here and slowly catching on. As computing and network capability spreads into our everyday lives and appliances, it was only a matter of time before we had a smart rifle. A company called Tracking Point has developed the first one, although other manufacturers are right behind. Joining us is freelance journalist Dara Kerr, whose article about the smart rifle was published on CNET.com last week. She joins us by phone from Oakland, California. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
In reporting your story, you got to test drive one of these rifles from Tracking Point. Give us just a rundown about how it works, how it feels, and how well it worked.
Yeah, so these rifles, they're really big. They are up to 4 feet long and nearly 20 pounds. So, you know, when you're shooting one, it feels like you're, you know, you definitely have a, it's not a small gun in your hands. I'm not very familiar with guns, so they had the gun set up for me on a shooting table with a bipod because it's so big. The barrel needs to be propped up. And basically, I mean, should I walk through how it works? Or
well, yeah, I mean, what do you do? What's different about it? Then, of course, you're not a gun person, but just from what we imagine, you just pick up a gun, you try to heft it. If it has some heft, you try to hold it, and then you pull the trigger, right?
Yeah, but yeah.
What's different about this?
This is, if you are shooting a target that is still a non-moving target, you can't miss up to nearly half a mile.
Which is,
Well, half a mile is about 880 yards.
Okay.
And these guns have the capabilities of hitting up to 1,200 yards. So more than half a mile.
You mean can't miss hitting?
You can't miss. If it is a frozen target, like at a shooting range.
Okay.
That's the feeling I got after shooting the weapon. because these guns are enabled with a computer, the computer does all of the ballistics data that's needed to make a long-distance shot for the shooter.
So you're looking through a viewfinder?
Yes. So that's a, it's a scope, which most long-range, sorry, I have a little scratch in my throat. Most long-range rifles have an optical scope, so you can see long distances. And this scope has the computer within it, which is also enabled with a Wi-Fi antenna, and it's wired to the trigger. And so the computer does all of this thinking for the shooter to make the shot.
My guest is Dara Kerr. She's a journalist for CNET. She just wrote about the smart rifle that's on the market now. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So what type of information is the computer taking in to enable the rifle to be so accurate?
Well, first, you have to look at long-range shooting. And none of this I knew before reporting the story, but long-range shooting is highly mathematical. And most long-distance hunters keep what's called a dope book, which is this log for every bullet shot out of every rifle they've ever had. And that takes in everything, the curvature of the earth, the wind, the shot angle, cant, inclination, all these factors come into play when a bullet leaves the weapon's barrel. The way Tracking Point describes it to me kind of is like when you have a garden hose and you put your thumb over it, that's what the water is acting like the bullet. So it's always falling, and all these factors can make a difference of where it goes.
Mm-hmm.
So the gun takes in all of that information using the Wi-Fi antenna, and then displays it for the shooter on through the scope. So when you're looking through the scope, you don't just see what you're trying to shoot. You see a head-up display, which is typically used in military fighter jets. So that shows all of the data that the gun is gleaning.
These are expensive, right? $25,000 is pretty expensive for a rifle.
Yes.
Who's buying them?
For the most part, it's hobbyists, people that obviously have a lot of money and don't have the time to learn how to do long-range shooting, which, as I described, is really difficult. And so it's people that want to go on a fun trip to Africa or Alaska and shoot animals they normally wouldn't be able to.
What about military?
As far as I know, the military isn't using it, but it seems like something the military would want. The manufacturer isn't marketing it to the military. It's for a general consumption audience.
And the guy who developed it did it because he wanted to hunt game in Africa and wasn't able to achieve that without it.
Right. He had a frustrating experience when he was on safari, and he has a background in technology. And so on the way home, he drew up the plans on a napkin on the airplane for this weapon.
Kind of makes you wonder why it's taken so long, given, you know, I guess this is a next big step in technology for firearms.
Yeah, you know, I had that same question, and I asked the company that, and they said the man who was teaching me how to shoot the gun said the same thing, and he wondered why it had been so long, and now that he knows about everything that goes into this rifle, he can see why it took so long. It's extremely complex, the technology, yeah.
It has its own Wi-Fi signal, and it not only can link up to an iPad, but it comes with an iPad.
Exactly. And so whatever the shooter is seeing through the scope, that heads-up display is also beamed to an iPad. So a scout or a friend or a parent can help the person do the, you know, make the shot. Because if it's a moving target, it's a little more difficult. But with a still target, you can't miss.
Did anybody think that it kind of takes the fun out of it?
Yes, there has been, you know, in the article that published last week, there has been a lot of attention. There's been nearly 300 comments, and a lot of it is arguments between the people commenting of whether this is cheating, quote unquote, cheating or not. And, you know, there's a lot of arguments for and against. The company says it's just apples and oranges to a normal rifle and this rifle. It's as different as a bow and arrow is to a rifle.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about cheating, I guess all's fair in love and war, and that's where I think that the military would be interested. Who cares if you're cheating when you're trying to fight an enemy?
Exactly. Hmm. Yeah.
I mentioned earlier that tracking points rifles are the first type of gun like this on the market, but you said that's about to change.
Yeah, and that's what's really interesting to me is, you know, reporting this story made me think that it's the very first of this on the market, but as all technology goes, copycats pop up and technology gets cheaper and more widespread. And so there are a few other weapons that they're not brand new, but they've been in development. And I think, you know, seeing how well tracking points rifles work will only spur more innovators and startups to try their own take on a smart gun.
Tracking points manufacturer isn't a traditional firearms manufacturer, right? Or did they have have someone do it that is used? I mean, did they subcontract out the manufacturing?
No, they call themselves a technology company or an applied technology company. They don't call themselves a gun manufacturer. So everything they do is in shop all of the design and engineering. The actual rifle itself is made by a gun manufacturer called Surgeon. So everything that's kind of hooked on to the rifle is made by Tracking Point. So, but it comes, even though it's a technology company, you know, it's run by people who are gun enthusiasts.
All right. So we talked earlier about if you can afford it, then you can have it. And you're now you're saying that, you know, is more when with competition will become price changes. But even still, there are three different kinds of Tracking Point exact system rifles is what they call them. What's the difference between them besides the price?
The difference, so they range from $22,500 to $27,500 for price. And the difference basically is just how far of a distance each gun can shoot. So the top of the line one can hit up to 1,200 yards, and the lower one can hit up to 750 yards.
Are they keeping track of who they sell these to? Are gun rights groups concerned about what whose hands these might fall into?
They actually are keeping track. So as of now, and this could change, but as of now, they only sell directly to their customers.
Uh-huh.
So they do have a list, and they know they do little interviews with each customer, so they know who their customers are.
Do they limit how many a customer can purchase at a time?
I don't know that.
Well, Dara, thank you for joining us today to talk about it. Interesting.
Yes, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Dara Kerr is a journalist writing for CNET.com. We will continue with Tech Tuesday when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. There's nothing like the right camera at the right time, but these days most of us use the camera on our phone. It's a secondary consideration, right? Well, that's changing, and all you have to do is listen to the commercials to realize it. Here's a cut from the new Nokia Lumina commercial. Count how many times you hear the word phone.
Why aren't we getting closer?
With the Nokia Lumia 1020, we got the best seats in the house.
Let's get a group shot.
Meet the Nokia Lumia 1020 with 41 megapixels and reinvented zoom. Nothing else comes close.
You know, every day more photos are taken with an iPhone.
Right. Clearly, Nokia wants to differentiate itself as a camera and, oh yeah, with a phone. And Nokia isn't alone. A handful of manufacturers are working on the same thing. Joining us from New York to discuss some of the best cameras that also happen to be phones is Dan Seifert. Dan is an editor at TheVerge.com and co-host of their mobile show. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
First off, we hear a lot about pixels and megapixels when it comes to camera phones, but really, what makes a good camera and what should people really look for? Because pixels, I understand, is not it.
Yeah, there's been this myth for years that pixels are everything when it comes to using a camera. But when it comes to an actual camera phone or a camera that's on your smartphone, a lot of what makes it great is actually how fast it runs, how fast you can get that camera open out of your pocket and grab the moment that you're trying to capture.
You sent us your list of the best camera phones on the market. So it starts out with the Lumia and 1020 and the Lumia 925 from Nokia.
Well, I think the Nokia Lumias are fantastic cameras. They take great pictures in a lot of very difficult situations, whether you're in low light or indoors or have difficult lighting. But for most people, I think actually the iPhone 5S that Apple just released is probably the best overall camera phone that you can get just because of its speed of operation is so fast. You can pull it out of your pocket, open up the camera almost instantly, and grab the picture that you need. The Nokia Lumias take excellent photos, but they do tend to be a little bit slower in our experience.
When you say slower, you mean what slower in what way? When you're talking about the iPhone being faster, you mean because you can just pull it out and it's right there. You don't have to go to the camera icon and all that kind of baloney anymore.
Right. You can, with both phones, you can actually launch the camera right from your lock screen when you turn the phone right on.
Mm-hmm.
But the Nokia takes a beat or two longer to get that camera open and usable to take a picture, whereas the iPhone 5S is pretty instantaneous.
So you'd put the iPhone 5S, it's got the, basically the same resolution and so forth, are we saying all the resolutions are about the same? It's just how fast it works.
Well, the resolution, what that comes into effect is when you're trying to crop your image or blow your image up to a large size print, which mm-hmm. frankly, most people don't do these days. A lot of people are just sharing their photos on social networks or looking at them on their phones or their computers.
Mm-hmm.
The Nokia Lumia 1020 does have a lot of megapixels that you can crop into a lot. But at the end of the day, if you've missed the picture because your camera wasn't fast enough, all those megapixels aren't worth anything.
Okay, then there's the Sony, is it Xperia Z1?
That's correct. That's another new model that is making its way onto the market, and that does take some really excellent photos. If you're looking for an Android phone and you want the best camera that you can get, it probably is one of the better options on the market now.
And then there's the Samsung Galaxy S4, which we've been hearing about for a long time. People have preferred that camera.
Right. That's another one that takes great photos. It was very impressive when it came out earlier this year, and it's still one of the top options for you. Again, if you're looking for an Android phone and you want a nice big screen and all the things that come with Android phones, the Galaxy S4 does have an excellent camera, too.
My guest, if you're just joining us, is Dan Seifert. He's an editor at The Verge. We're talking about the best cameras that happen to be attached to phones. If you have a question or comment for Dan, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Check us out on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. A lot of attention gets paid to the camera and the lens, but let's talk about the APPS for a second. Instagram is really popular with that. For those who are unfamiliar, describe it and tell us why it's been so successful.
Well, the magic with Instagram is that you can take photos with your phone. You can tweak them just a little bit with some really basic filters that for most people make them look better almost instantaneously. And then you can share it with all of your friends on Facebook or Twitter, or if you have a Tumblr page, you can share it right there directly from within the app. And that's really the ease of operation and the speed at which it does everything is really what's made Instagram so popular these days.
What about the app? Is it called VSCO, ViscoCam?
Yeah, that's another one that's similar to Instagram in what it offers, but it is got for people who are really into their photography and really want to take the best photos that they can get with their smartphones. ViscoCam offers a lot of different filters that you can apply to it, and then you can even go beyond that and tweak various settings for how bright your photo is or the how much color or lack of color your photo has. And it's really been loved by a lot of photographers.
And then there's the app Snapseed.
Right. Snapseed is an app that you use after you've taken your photo. So if you've captured your photo and you saved it on your phone, you can then open it in Snapseed and you can edit it to your heart's content. It offers a lot of editing options. So you can really tweak how the photo looks and really get the impact or the image that you're trying to get from the beginning. And it's very simple to use on a touchscreen device. It's really a very well done app.
And let's just talk about, well, what about the lens? Are any of the phones improving the lenses? I guess the Nokia Lumia that we were just talking about, you can get a closer up image than with the other phones, right?
Well, it seems that every new generation of phone has a better lens on it than the prior generation. Either that it's brighter than before and it lets more light into the camera so that you can get better pictures in low light, or it is sharper than before. If you're looking at these models of phones that we've been mentioning, all of them have excellent lenses. They're all glass lenses. Some of them have special coatings and stuff that they try to brand and market. But at the end of the day, they're all very good lenses that offer you sharp photos, You can get pretty close to your subjects with almost any of them. And they do let in a lot of light, which lets you take better pictures in low light.
What do you think the future of the standalone camera is?
It's hard to say. You know, as someone who's got a lot of experience in photography, I've done a lot of professional photography in the past, I used to carry around a separate camera with me almost all of the time. But nowadays, I don't. I rely on my smartphone for probably 90% of the photos that I take for my own personal use. And it seems that a lot of people are going the same route or have been going the same route for years. As these smartphone cameras get better and better with each generation, it becomes less and less of a requirement to carry a separate camera around with you.
I mean, what do you really think of it, as a camera or a phone first?
You know, I don't think of it as either, because it's a computer that's in your pocket. Mm-hmm. You can do so many things with these. You can make phone calls, you can take pictures, you can browse the internet, you can send emails. It's hard to really like peg the devices as specifically camera or specific phone or something like that. There really are multifunction devices that we have with us today.
What about the panoramic option with the iPhones? Is it worth it? I've used it a couple times, but it's kind of a hassle too. How often do you need to do that?
Well, it all depends on what the image that you're trying to capture is. If you're trying to capture a very wide vista view, the panoramic option is actually pretty cool and is very effective for doing that. I would say that most of the camera phones or phones on the market today do have a panoramic option available. The iPhone is the best execution, though. It's definitely the easiest to use and gives you the best result.
In general, you've run the gamut with photography yourself. You just described that. What are some good tips for getting good photos with a camera phone nowadays, besides just pointing and shooting?
So the tips that you would use for getting good pictures with your smartphone are the same principles that you'd use if you're using a traditional camera. It takes time to compose your shot so that you are capturing the image that you want, and then take time to play around with different angles. Maybe move your camera lower than you normally would be, or climb up on something to get a different perspective than just holding the phone in front of your face and taking the picture like you're instinctively want to do.
Are you surprised at the popularity of Instagram?
I don't think so. I think it's a very well-made app, and it's very easy to use, and it makes it very easy to share your photos with everyone. So I think, you know, its popularity is pretty well-deserved.
You know, there's some lenses that some phones have clip-on lenses. I don't know if all of them do or not, but there are some accessories like that. What do you make of those?
The accessories, they can do various things, like maybe give you a little more zoom on your, so you can get closer to a faraway subject. But they always require that you set them up. So if you're trying to capture something quickly, you've got to take your phone out of your pocket, and then you've got to attach this accessory, and then you've got to set it up and everything. It slows down the whole process for most people. And in our experience, testing them out and things, you can do some interesting things with them, but at the end of the day, they are usually not worth the time and setup that is involved.
You've seen the Nokia commercial that we had a cut from. Do you think that's what it's coming to? It doesn't seem that bad. The people are that addicted.
People are capturing more photos than ever today with their smartphones, because the old adage is the best camera that you have is the one that you have with you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when your smartphone is always in your pocket or in your bag, it is the camera that you have with you, and it's making it very easy to capture all of these moments today and share them with people.
Do you think videos are going to become more popular? There's a little of that here and there, but not as much.
Yeah, the big hang-up with videos has always been that it's difficult to share them, because they tend to be much larger file sizes, so they take a lot longer to share over a cellular network. But as the cellular networks have gotten faster, we're now into what they call 4G, so we have really fast wireless connections. It's a lot easier to share video clips. And recently, just this year, Instagram added a video option, which has been pretty popular. There's another very popular app called Vine, which is actually made by Twitter, for sharing short video clips. And I really think that video is going to get more and more common, more and more popular, and much easier to share and use as time goes on.
It's amazing what some people have done with those short video clips.
Oh, yeah. It's quite amazing how some of the more creative people have been able to take these 6 to 10 second video clips and produce really amazing results with them.
So what's next, Dan? What do you see coming down the pike?
Well, I think that as the generations of smartphones get better and improved, we're going to see even better performance in low light. It's still pretty hard to take a picture of a running toddler indoors in low light. And I think that's what everyone wants to do, right? They want to take pictures of their family and share them with their family and take pictures of their pets and their kids. And if they're moving around a lot, it's still pretty difficult to do, even if you have the best smartphone on the market. So I think as technology goes on and things get improved, we'll see better and better results from there.
It's funny because it makes me think something's never changed. I was looking at an old photo album from the 20s, and they were all outside. And I wondered, why are they all outside? Why are all of these pictures outside? And it was because they didn't have flash yet. I mean, they had flash, but your average shutterbug didn't have flash.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's like taking pictures indoors is still hard to do. We're many decades on from then, and it's still something that we're trying to figure out. We've come a long way, that's for sure. There's always room for improvement, that's for sure.
All right, Dan Seifert, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about it. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks again.
Dan Seifert, he's an editor at TheVerge.com. Coming up, Russell Holly from Geek.com. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Dan Fisher. For well over a year now, we've been hearing about Google Glass, a wearable computer with a small visual display. The hype and skepticism about this device has been building, but you still can't walk into a store and buy one. Joining us now to discuss when we all might be able to wear Google Glass if we want to is Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com. Welcome, Russell.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
So Google has just announced a cross-country tour for Google Glass. What do they have planned for us?
So it's hard to be entirely clear. They announced it earlier this week, and what we saw was that they decided that they're going to go to a couple of specific locations. It looks like most of them will probably be college campuses across the U.S., and they're going to have that they're going to try and recreate the testing experience that they give in their New York and San Francisco offices. So basically what that means is you'll be able to, schedule an appointment and then go and try them on. You'll have a specific person there. They call them glass guides to kind of walk you through the basics of how glass works. And then, you'll be able to leave. It doesn't seem like they're going to make them available for purchase, but it's an opportunity to go and kind of try it out if you're interested.
It's sort of like they're indoctrinating people.
Yeah, it's so this was a commentary that I made when I first heard about the trip is that this has been an incredibly long hype campaign from Google when you look at the duration of this. And when we first heard about Glass almost 2 years ago now. They released kind of a teaser video. It was April of 2012 that they announced the teaser video, and then at their developer conference they offered a little more information. But it was a solid year from when I signed up to be one of the explorers that they even called me up to New York to have me get one to try them out, and that was for their developer program. So it's a lot of people are very, very curious to see, how long it's going to take Google to get this stuff, into people's hands. And a lot of the past couple of months has been kind of refining the Glass experience and making the user interface, something that's easy for people to understand. And then getting third-party developers to write apps for it is another thing that's going to take time. But the whole thing, we're looking at 2 years now before Google's even ready to talk about them being put on shelves. And this is a cross-country teaser tour that seemed really odd.
I wondered how much damage like that Saturday Night Live skit might have done to him.
I think that the Saturday Night Live, I thought that was really funny.
I thought it was hilarious.
And it almost made me self-conscious for like a week afterwards. Anytime I tilted my head up to try and weight glass up, like when I was driving or something. And it wasn't because, it wasn't because you have to do those quick jerk ups like they did in the Saturday Night Live skit. It really is just kind of a gentle nod up. But it did. It made me, like, anytime I was out, like, at Starbucks or something like that, and I went to, look up to try and wake the screen up, I was immediately self-conscious after that video. So it's certainly possible. I thought it was really funny, though.
When you were walking around with the Google Glass on, when you were using it, did people come up to talk to you about it?
Or did they
just think you look like a weirdo and they didn't want to go?
I've talked to a couple people about this, because they come in so many different colors.
Yeah.
And a couple of my colleagues have them in bright colors. Robert Scoble has it in bright orange, and a couple of my other friends have it in this kind of sky blue. But I kind of went with the boring black version.
Uh-huh.
So when I wear it on my face, because I wear regular glasses, it just kind of, a lot of people just assume that it's an extension of my actual glasses. I actually went to a family visit, and my grandfather thought that it was just, extra vision correction on my face until he saw it light up and do stuff. But so I think that for me, a lot of people just assume that it's an extension of my glasses. But I do get people who are familiar with the technology who have, who have read about it on the internet, who have seen the Saturday Night Live sketch, immediately ask me, is that Google's Glass? And it's probably... 50% of the time when someone recognizes what it is, that they immediately know, what it is on my head.
I'm still sort of trying to figure out why they call it Google Glass.
it's definitely a unique name.
I don't know why we always end up talking about names, too, but...
We do talk about names a lot.
It's probably me, but it just, I don't know. So, all right, why is Google Glass not ready for prime time, though? Why can't we go out and buy it? Why not just put it out there and let people buy it? I mean, they tweak stuff all the time when it comes to different kinds of products, like, pick your iPhone.
Yeah, but I think the idea here is that this is something that ideally the user would, throughout the course of a day, not take off. And that becomes important when you're doing things like driving or, walking around and doing things. You really have to balance, the number of distractions you have floating in front of your eye when you're dealing with something like that. Because, I personally drive with glass all the time. But when I do, I mute all of my notifications and I use it primarily for GPS when I'm driving. If I get like a text message from my wife or something like that, then I'll have that come through. But it's usually, kind of balancing distraction versus, practical application. And I think Google, they had a cool idea, but they didn't really know what to do with it. And so instead of just kind of sending it out in the world where it could potentially fail when people put it on and went, well, this thing doesn't do much.
Mm-hmm.
They tried to get, they tried to get other people to help them define what this thing was going to do. But I think that, I think that for a lot of people, it's taken them way too long to now we've kind of reached the other side of that fence where it's taken them too long to put it out there for other people. I don't know if this cross-country tour is to make sure that there are people still interested or just kind of because they think they can stretch this a little longer until they get the finished product ready. It's really hard to tell mm-hmm. at this point.
Remember the Segway when they were rolling that thing out and everyone thought, well, remember the build up to that was the next greatest thing. It will change the world as we know it. And then it was a Segway, which was kind of cool, but it didn't change the world. And people do tours of, downtown Miami on them. But other than that, it's not like an everyday thing. Do you think Google Glass could become something that would be, incorporated once they get the kinks out of it?
I definitely think that it's something that a significant group of people would be interested in using, if they can get past, the fact that it does kind of look funny on your face, especially if you don't wear glasses. If you don't wear glasses, I definitely think that it looks kind of odd. But if you wear glasses, then it doesn't seem like, at least to me, it doesn't seem like such a big deal. I think a big part of that is, how effective it is in certain environments, particularly driving. I can't overstate how different it feels to drive with glass on than without, especially when I'm going to someplace I've never been before.
Interesting. One of our young parents on staff says there's a pic online of a baby wearing one and it looks weird. And they wonder, is that really safe or should we get our kids used to this early? Which kind of goes with the whole college campus thing.
Yeah. I think the picture of the baby was a joke from one of the Googlers.
Okay.
Way, way back. When they were first like announcing the process, I think I remember that picture. But yeah, it is, you know, it is something that, you know, and we've talked about this before too, where, you know, the younger generation is going to pick it up immediately, and kind of run with it. And that's something, you know, each one of my daughters has, you know, worn this thing maybe two or three times. And what really blew me away was that, you know, they picked up the touch gestures and things like that immediately. You know, they watched me do it a couple minutes and they had it completely figured out, which I thought was pretty phenomenal.
You know, do you know how much they test these things with children versus adults?
I don't, but I think that's something
that's an interesting
worth finding out.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're looking forward. They have to be.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What does your grandpa think of it, by the way?
My grandfather is not. He's very electrically minded. He can, you know, rewire just about anything, but he's not a huge fan of computers or anything like that. And so when I put it on him, it was really interesting for him to look at things like pictures through that experience and you know, text and things like that. It wasn't something that, you know, he would ever be interested in wearing, but he picked up pretty quickly, you know, how to use it and why it would be useful to certain groups of people.
My guest is Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com. If you have a tech question for Russell, you know, have at it, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there for Russell. You do not have to limit it to the topics at hand. What do you need to know? Only two people have ever stumped Russell so far in the now almost going on 3 years, Russell.
Yeah, we've been doing this for a while.
Weird, huh? Another Google project. Or another project Google is working on is to make it easier to share what's on your phone screen with other screens. Tell us about Google Open Project.
So Open Project is a much longer term project, and this is something that ties into the idea that, you know, a lot of the screens around us within the next couple of years are going to become touch screens.
Mm-hmm.
And so what this project is doing essentially is creating an open platform where you can take an application that's running on your phone and share it to a touchscreen such that you'd be able to touch the touchscreen and interact with the application even though it's running on your phone.
Okay, so that means that I have it, it's running on my phone, but I could pick up my iPad and do it?
Well, yeah, so it would be, you know, if you had a touch television or if you had a touch screen on a desktop or something like that. Larger screens, I think, are the goal.
Mm-hmm.
But it's certainly possible that the iPad would be included in that as long as there was an application on the tablet to support that. But the idea here is that you would have, you know, the ability to. I guess the easiest way to think of it right now would be more from an office standpoint, from a professional standpoint, where you can take an application and you can share it on this larger screen and then, you know, continue to interact with it without having to have a computer hooked up to that screen. So you'd be able to interact as though your phone was plugged into this great big monitor that was also touch capable. But it wouldn't have to be physically connected. It would all be done wirelessly.
That looks like a really, I can see that application because a lot of times when people do speaking engagements, they're like, please tell me I don't have to use the computer with that because it's such a hassle for some people. That seems like it would make it very easy. What about in everyday life? Can you imagine how you would use it besides that?
So this, like I said, this is kind of a longer shoot project, and I can see personally this being useful in environments where, like, you know, for instance, in my house, we have, you know, kind of a centralized device for keeping things like grocery lists and things like that. We have, you know, we jokingly call it the kitchen computer.
I can't imagine what it's like to live in your house.
it's a tablet that we keep in the kitchen, and I use it mostly for recipes and cooking and stuff. But it also becomes kind of a central device for adding to the calendar and things like that. We've essentially replaced like the big paper calendar and stuff like that. It all goes, and the grocery list and everything all goes on this tablet, and then it syncs to each one of our phones. And no, that's not something that I think most people should have in their houses yet, but it's possible in the future. But, so I could see for me personally that being, you know, something that gets replaced because, you know, I wouldn't have to worry about, the performance of that device or whether or not that screen, you know, could get damaged in the kitchen because it would just be a touch display. And so I could just share, the application to the display and anybody could reach out and interact with it.
Everything's going to be touch eventually, right?
I think that's certainly the direction that we're headed in. I think that, you know, a lot of people have figured out that physical buttons, they break a lot easier and there's fewer things that you can do with them than if everything is a touch environment. So I do believe that is the direction that we're headed.
So do you imagine a future where all of our screens are connected and interactive? I guess it's kind of inevitable when you're just talking about what you're doing already.
Yeah, so I think right now, we have a lot of different – we really have the potential to do that right now, but everything is kind of split up into these different, you know, platforms still. We still have Microsoft and Google and Apple kind of all trying to do their own thing. And the cool thing is that if you can kind of curb your lifestyle to one of those environments, then you kind of already can, live in a world where all of your content is synced across all of these devices. And I think it's probably easier on Google's devices than anything else right now, but it is certainly possible with Microsoft and Apple as well. So I definitely think that, you know, within the next couple of years, we will see some kind of, data unity across these platforms that'll make it so that we can have, kind of all of our information across all of our devices at the same time.
How much will all the device makers have to cooperate to achieve that?
Really, it's going to become service oriented, I think. What you're looking at there is how users want to interact with that data. Not so much, I think right now the problem is that, these companies have figured out that the data is important and it's valuable, so they want to keep it in kind of their house and do their thing with it. But I think that what will happen next is people figuring out that what is more important is offering a service that makes people want to keep using that service. Without having to lock the data into that platform.
Do you think it will, something like Google's Open Project that lets you manipulate your apps and control your apps remotely and so forth, will increase the number of apps we use or decrease the number of apps we use? Because it's kind of ridiculous how many apps are out there now. And it's hard enough.
Absolutely.
But if you could use one app in more ways, I don't know.
It's certainly true. I mean, and I get this kind of slack jawed stare from a couple of people that I work with when I say that, I really only use, five or six apps on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
I will occasionally try new things out. And if I'm doing something special, then I will go and look for an app that'll help make that thing special. But I think most people, if they're really honest with themselves, probably use fewer than 10 apps every single day. So I do think that, the number of apps that we have is kind of crazy, especially since a lot of them offer kind of overlapping features. So I do think that in the future we will probably have more apps to do more things, but they'll be kind of, specialty things that we'll only use on limited occasions.
Once again, my guest, Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Matt in Columbus. He says that most versions of the iPhone 5S are showing not available for shipping until later this month or well into November. Is this a blunder in logistics / demand on Apple's end or just typical demand?
I think it's impossible to call this a blunder at this point. Apple... They had the numbers from last year, where they sold a certain number of phones within the within the first week, and it's clear that they planned accordingly because they sold 20% more for this year than they did last year for the iPhone 5S over the iPhone 5. So it's clear that they had the product on hand. The demand was just that much higher, and I think at that point when you realize that the iPhone 5S has quite literally broken records in terms of how many devices have been sold in the last week. It's just impossible to account for that. And what's really interesting is that, you know, Apple has had some shipping delays when you order on the web, but they're still shipping phones to stores every single day. The iPhone 5S, the Apple store in my area in Colombia has lines outside of the store. It's still every single morning. There's, 15 or 20 people waiting in line outside the store. Whatever that store was able to get a hold of the night before, they sell through as soon as the store opens. So it's easy to look back without the sales numbers and stuff and see this as kind of a, logistics thing or Apple kind of creating demand where there wasn't one. But when you look at the sales numbers, it is really clear that this is just an unprecedented level of demand that no company could have possibly anticipated.
It reminds me of Wii, when the Wii first came out.
Yeah, absolutely. And what was funny about the Wii launch was that crazy demand wasn't the first week. It was like 2 months after. It built up, and then once it was kind of odd because once everyone figured it out, then they just kind of moved forward. But yeah, very similar in that they are shipping them. they're getting them to the stores as quickly as possible. They're just not staying.
Okay, we have a call from Armando in Columbus. Hi, Armando. You're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hey, I just had a question. What is the holdup or the drawback to releasing the NFC technology in these new phones? I know that was kind of the wish list on the new Apple iPhone 5S, and it seems like every time they release a new iPhone, that's on the wish list. I just was wondering what does the panelists think is the holdup in releasing that technology?
Russell, what is NFC first before you answer the question?
NFC is near field communication.
Oh, that's right.
A
I don't
lot
know.
Of okay. different phones.
Yeah.
But it's not on the iPhone for a couple of reasons. One is an oddly technical reason, in that Apple's phones are mostly metal, and near field communication doesn't play particularly well with metal. Even on the HTC One, which has an all-aluminum back, NFC only works up near the camera, and it took some very clever engineering in order to get that to work. So I think that there would have to be some hardware concessions that Apple would have to make in order for that to work correctly. But more importantly, the guys from Apple, their party line, their official statement is that they don't see a single direct benefit for NFC. And what you see in the Android world is very much a lot of the same thing. NFC is great for tinkers. I personally love NFC. I've done a lot of really clever things with NFC in my house, but it's not something that I would expect, my mom or my sister to have set up and done the same. As long as the carriers are going to continue bickering over who is allowed to process mobile payments via NFC, then it's not really going to matter that NFC exists on one phone or not, because Google Wallet tried and failed to release that feature and to give a clear direction and clear purpose to NFC, but then it got blocked by AT&T and T-Mobile and Verizon because of their partnership with ISIS to deliver a very similar service. So it's really. It's a really cool idea for geeks. I personally am a big fan of NFC, but it's not really there for the average user yet.
Apple said the 7-inch screen would never make it either, and what do they know?
But, absolutely true. But, I personally, it's six in one, half dozen in the other. I think that if you give people the technology, they'll find a reason to use it.
Right.
But it does help to explain how it would be useful. And that's something that a lot of people have trouble doing in one concise sentence.
Susan in Columbus, you're on the air. We have about 30 seconds. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I just wanted to know, since iGoogle is going out of business, as it were, in November, what to use instead?
Russell?
Oh, okay. So the iGoogle service... So iGoogle was created to kind of centralize a bunch of different random things into one location, and Google got rid of it because not a lot of people were using it.
Mm-hmm.
But what you will find, I think, with if you are a Chrome user, is that the Chrome homepage offers a lot of that same information, and there's actually a Chrome extension that replaces iGoogle and offers that same kind of news layout where you can kind of set things in each area that you would want to use.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that there's a universal replacement. You know, so if you're still using the Internet Explorer or if you're using Mozilla Firefox, then I don't. If memory serves, then there's not a replacement for iGoogle in that. But if you're using Chrome, then there is a Chrome extension that will replace those features.
Okay. Russell Holly, thanks again, as usual.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holly, geek tech blogger for geek.com, and a self-described geek today as well. Thanks to everybody for listening and for your calls and your emails. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.